Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV and teaching a class in interactive media studies with via Miami University web conference. I'm very happy to have Andrew Ferguson, who's a writer at the Weekly Standard and Bloomberg News, columnist there, and a veteran of TV Guide, The American Spectator, the George H.W. Bush White House, and about a dozen other places. Andy, thanks for coming out and talking to IMS390B.
Well, thank you for caring enough to ask me.
Okay, very good. Guys, as we've done before, I would like to throw it open to you. What we're going to do, we'll talk for about an hour. And, I want to talk first about the pieces that we discussed in class that we read of Andy's. And then we'll talk a little bit about media questions, about how new media is affecting discourse and journalism in general. And then we'll talk a little bit about Andy's career trajectory and where, at what point in that Challenger shuttle arc are you? Are you still on the launch pad or are you in the first few seconds of flight or what? So who would like to have the first question?
We looked at some of your stuff with Lincoln, and I guess just have you had anything spark your interest as much as doing biographies as him, any other historic figures or even current contemporary figures?
Well, that's a good question. The only reason I did a whole book about Lincoln was I've really got the journalistic mentality, which is if I'm working on a piece for longer than about 2 weeks, I get really bored really fast. And I thought, well, Lincoln was somebody I'd always been interested in, and maybe I could actually be interested for two entire years that it would take to write a book. And it turned out I was. I'm still interested in him, but it's very rare that I can find something like that that, is a single thing that really holds your interest. The nice thing about that Lincoln book was if I got lost and I didn't know, should I go off in this direction or this direction, I could just come back to him. Right now I'm writing a book on college admissions, which is a much more diffuse subject, So I don't have this kind of central figure to go back to the way I did with Lincoln, and it gets much harder that way. I wish I could find another historical figure or a political figure or anything that interested me as much, but...
Talk a little bit about the college admissions book. What stage are you at, and what are you looking to do with that?
Well, I've got a son who's applying to college right now, and this is all fresh to you guys, but it's new to me, or at least the way things are done now. I just noticed that it was much different from what it was like when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And my son started
Where did you go to undergrad, and when did you apply?
I went in 74, so I must have applied 73 and 74. So that's more than 30 years ago. But all of a sudden, my son started getting solicitations in the mail and stuff that just never would have happened back in 1970, at least not to me.
And you were in Southern California?
No, I was in Illinois.
Okay, in Illinois. But did you go to UCLA?
No, I went to Occidental College.
So, in Los Angeles.
Yeah, in LA.
So that's one more thing you have in common with Barack Obama.
That's right. He actually started. He started the year after my senior year.
Mm-hmm. And Occidental is also where the broken-down old quarterback Jack Kemp went, correct?
You mean the AFC star?
Yeah, AFL star.
Jack Kemp. Right.
So what's the difference? I mean, is your book going to follow your son's application process?
Yeah, it's going to be both. I'll go through, talk about what he's going through, which is just bizarre by the lights of somebody my age with test prep and, private college admissions counselors. Mm-hmm. And I was just up in New York interviewing this woman who charges $35,000 to get a kid into college. So if anybody's looking for a nice line of work, and then I'll go to a general discussion of the various, how it's changed over the years. But the thing is, you really need a person to anchor the thing. I think that's true of journalism, too. The more you can make it personal and about somebody and tell a story through a person, the better it is.
What is the short version? I mean, your Lincoln book is an incredibly rich book, and one of the ways it plays into some of the themes that we're talking about in this class is kind of reception theory, or how individuals use pre-existing culture or pre-existing artifacts to their own ends. And we talk about that more on kind of a cyberspace level, but Lincoln is one of these things where Lincoln existed in a historical period, and then he's appropriated, reappropriated, misappropriated again and again. What is what's the essence of Lincoln that makes him so available to people?
Well, two things, and it sounds like a contradiction. On the one hand, he's very familiar to us. You know, he was probably the first figure in America to be photographed and have his photograph distributed in mass quantities. And Lincoln was extremely conscious of public relations and never turned down a chance to have his picture made. He wanted he wanted people to relate to him as a physical figure, and so he had this sent all over. So he was already sort of hip to this idea that the more people see me, the more they'll think about me, the more they'll think about me, the more they'll like me, and that sort of thing. So that's one thing. He looks, you know, we don't have pictures of Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, so we can relate to him in a way that we can't to these older figures. But at the same time, he's elusive. That is, that he was such a weird guy. He was, you know, somebody called him the most shut-mouthed man I ever met. He never talked about his own private feelings. He never kept a diary. People who knew him gave contradictory pictures of him. Mm-hmm. So he's endlessly fascinating in that way. You can keep digging and digging and digging, and you never get to the end of it. So it's this combination of familiarity and elusiveness that makes him particularly fascinating.
Okay. Next question. This is college, like the Jetsons.
That's exactly what it is.
In the article, Time Embraces a Timeless Idea, you criticize Time Magazine. You also address that the magazine is postponing its inevitable demise. Why do you think this, and do you see other magazines or all magazines or newspapers diminishing away?
Oh. Well, I'm not a very good expert on the economics of media, so I probably can't make too sound of a prediction about that. But for as long as I've been in the journalism business, people have been predicting the demise of the news magazines. And just because they were overtaken by radio, and then they were overtaken by TV, and now people are saying, well, they're going to be overtaken by the web. And I think it is inevitable that they have to die, because they don't even fulfill a use that they've tried to reconceive for themselves. You know, now I think Time is trying to be an opinion magazine, more or less, with little weird graphics and bits of information thrown in. And it just can't do that as well as other magazines can. It's got this huge legacy of behind it. People will never relate to it the way they relate to opinion magazines. So they've kind of gone off a course that I think is inevitably going to fail. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to die in the next 4 or 5 years. What happens at Time Magazine is that they get a new editor every 4 or 5 years, and he announces that he's going to reinvent the magazine. Mm-hmm. And, oh, we're going to throw out the book and start over. And, you know, when it comes back, it kind of looks the same. It's kind of just as boring as it was before. You know, a little difference here, a little difference there. And after 4 or 5 years, you realize, oh, geez, this is just Time Magazine. And then they fire that guy and they get a new one.
Were you a columnist at Time for a while? So how did you conceive of, and how did they produce and edit pieces at Time, say, that would be different than working at the American Spectator or working at the Weekly Standard?
Well, you could never take your gloves off, really. They have huge institutional responsibilities that they feel very acutely.
The Claire Booth Luce jokes right out the window.
right. Yeah. And not just that, but all kinds of things. And they have advertisers that they have to worry about. I when there was a big tobacco settlement back in the 90s, they asked me to write this thing because they knew I was a chain smoker, and I had to write it overnight and send it to them. And they were clearly worried about what the tobacco companies would say. Tobacco companies, for a long time there, have been keeping a lot of Time Incorporated magazines afloat.
Right.
So the other thing that you get in an opinion magazine that you don't have in Time is that you can assume a kind of audience that has a certain mm-hmm. level of knowledge. If somebody's going to go pick up the New Republic or the Weekly Standard, it's because they're interested in politics, they're interested in cultural matters, and they probably know a lot about mm-hmm. it. Time magazine deliberately does not target that reader. Mm-hmm. And so you can't make the kind of allusions and the kind of easy jokes and things that you can at the mm-hmm. other magazines.
You also wrote a column for a while for TV Guide, right?
Yeah.
How was that? I mean, editorially, were you pretty independent, or were you free to talk about what you wanted? Because TV Guide and Time are both massive circulation magazines.
Yeah.
And is there something when you get to a certain level of audience where you just, you can't be that interesting?
Yes, that I think it really happens. You have to be... worry so much about offending people, and you have to be so inoffensive that you do have to worry about being interesting to anyone.
Other than
that's
your
part
banker,
of
right?
Well, that's right. But that's part of the, it's part of the economic plan, it's the business plan, is to be inoffensive so that nobody will throw you out, but also be, give a product that they need, which mm-hmm. in TV Guide's case is no longer...
Right.
Nobody needs it any longer, and so mm-hmm. it doesn't really exist in any form that it's recognizable.
Next question.
To go back to your book, Land of Lincoln, in the video that we watched.
I'm sorry, Megan, you're dropping out.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
In the video that we watched with you, you mentioned...
And just so you know, it was your presentation at the Commonwealth Club.
Oh, okay.
So.
Is that the one where I started coughing?
Okay.
I think I... Well, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You mentioned how many books there are written about Lincoln, and I was just wondering how you kind of tackled the feat of setting your book apart from all the rest.
Oh, well, I was acutely aware of that, and so the first line of the book is something like, there have been 14,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln, and half of them begin by saying there have been 14,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln, and this book is one of them. And so I immediately wanted to sort of disarm anybody who wanted to pick it up in a bookstore.
So you were going for the soft bigotry of low expectations
yeah.
in the reader? Okay.
I was hoping to get an ironic reader with that. So that's really all you can do, and then you have to hope that somebody gets far enough into the book to see that, well, this isn't a book about something I've read before. It's slightly different. And
it's funny you mentioned irony, because with Lincoln obsessives, or I guess obsessives in general, they
yeah.
generally, one thing they're short on is irony.
Right.
How was the reception to the book?
It was, critically and everything, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
Among the Lincoln community, if you can use that, I hate that word, but, the Lincoln world, most of them really disliked it. And, for example, the National Park Service refused to carry the book
mm-hmm.
Because of unkind things I say about the National Park Service, which is too bad, because that would have been a perfect... Those bookstores and historical sites are great places to sell that book.
Mm-hmm.
And then something called the Abraham Lincoln Bookstore, which is sort of the nerve center of the whole Lincoln world in Chicago, refused to stock it mm-hmm. and even made a point to put up a sign saying, if you're looking for this. So I was told, anyway. And a number of people don't speak to me anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was.
Were you speaking to them before you had started the book, or are you just making
an overstatement? No. There are people who I thought I had kind of developed a relationship with, not just as sources, but it turned out not to be true.
Really? Okay. Next question. Okay, Cassie.
Well, first, just after that conversation, why do so many people refuse to carry the book?
Well, I mean, most people did. All the bookstore, big bookstores did. But in the case of, the Abraham Lincoln bookstore, I, have an ironic treatment, I guess you could say, or a not totally serious and long-faced view of a lot of people in the Lincoln world, so collectors and people who take Lincoln very seriously. And as Nick says, irony and a sense of humor are not real high on their list. So when they saw themselves, I don't think anybody, you know, just like a lot of people don't like having their picture taken or something, a lot of people, when they get written about, don't like what they see. And I was not trying to do a hit job on anybody. I've done hit jobs. I know what it's like to do a hit job. And I was not trying to do a hit job on anybody. I was trying to convey the weirdness of people who build their lives around Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, if they came off as weird, well, my belief is because they're weird.
Oh, sorry.
No, let's go ahead.
But that was, I haven't had a chance to read the book, but after your speech, I kind of want to pick it up. Just, I was very intrigued by some of your stories, especially the whole Lincoln convention where the 100 impersonators gathered in Santa Claus's cabin or whatever.
Right.
But I was just wondering, who was the weirdest person you met around your travels, and could you tell us that story?
Oh, boy. Well, one of the weirdest things, it's hard to say, but one of the weirdest things that happened was, although you probably heard this story, but the guy who was one of these Lincoln presenters and who looked incredibly like Abraham Lincoln with the coloring and the hair and the beard was perfect. He was really tall, and he even had the famous Lincoln mole, which is right there, and I was talking to him and complimenting how great he looked. I mean, he was really fantastic, kind of eerie. And he said, "You've even got the mole there." He goes, "Oh, yeah, here, take it." And he dug into his thing and pulled out this thing. And it turned out what he'd done was take the eraser from a number two pencil and clipped it on and put it on with epoxy. And that's how he started the day. Every morning he would get up and put in his clip a new little eraser. And so...
What, you know, one of the things that the students responded to, and I think your readers in general do, is that you're funny and scathing and very opinionated, but there's always, in your writing, there's always a human, a kind of core of humanity or humaneness that comes through.
Well, that's a failure in the editing.
Okay.
We're going to have to get that part out of there.
But, I mean, clearly that's part of your authorial intention. And, you know, how do you conceive of stories like that? Or how does that come back?
Well, the funny part is I want to be... Mark Twain said something about how humor is supposed to be... He used the word lagniappe, which... everybody tells me is not a word you should use, which just means it's something extra that comes out when you're doing something else. So I want the humor to be kind of a byproduct. Just as I'm trying to explain something or tell something about somebody, that the humor just kind of comes out naturally. And, you know, I would hate to be thought of as a humorist because it's setting the bar too high. I don't tell jokes very well. So the humor just has to be part of you know, almost by the by, as I tell the story. As far as scathing, well, I you know, sometimes I just get mad about something.
Mm-hmm.
But I would hate to be thought of as not, you know, as inhuman. And usually if I get mad at somebody and write about them, it's because I think that they're trying to deny another kind of humanity to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Next question. Yeah, Nick in the back.
So I was kind of interested in your time as a speechwriter for President Bush. I was just kind of curious how you found yourself in this position, and did you enjoy that type of writing compared to what you do now?
Well, no, I didn't enjoy it at all. For a couple of different reasons. I got in because somebody at the White House called me. In fact, he's a guy who sort of became famous later, Tony Snow, who was the other President Bush's chief spokesman for a while and just died a while back. He asked me to do this, and it was just for 1992, which was when the first President Bush was running for re-election and got slaughtered.
He ended up getting, what, like 38%?
37 or 38.
Yeah, okay.
He had a good sense of humor. He once said to me, when you started to work for me, I had a 48% approval rating, and after 3 months, you'd got me down to the lower 30s. But anyway, I decided to do it because I kind of liked him. I liked him as a man. I mean, I thought he was an admirable person. I didn't think he was a very good president. And I, in fact, what was out about it is I had been writing pieces and editorials for the Scripps Howard newspaper chain, which went all around the country, and they were scathing about Bush. I mean, really, really, some of them were just unkind. But they didn't hold that against me, and he didn't anyway. And so I went and I just did it for that 1 year of 1992, and then we got forcibly removed when the Clinton people came in. The type of writing is almost almost you can't even begin to compare it to what a journalist does. It's the only things in common are, you know, you have to be you have to organize material well, try and put it in a story, try and be as clear as you can, and hope for the best. But this stuff, writing in the White House, was what would happen is you'd get a little slip of paper that said the president is going to speak at the Head Start Clinic in Baltimore 2 days from now, and he's going to unveil a new Head Start initiative. So give us, you know, we need 10 minutes of remarks. So you call up somebody at the Health and Human Services Department and say, can you tell me about our new Head Start initiative? And they don't know anything about it, so they send you to somebody else, and you go, so finally you find somebody who knows about it, and he sends you over all this really boring material that you have to read through, and you think, how am I going to make a speech out of this? And then you try and do it, and you get what you think is okay. And then, this is the worst part, every speechwriter has this same complaint in the White House. You produce the speech and send it around to at least 20 different people in the White House, all of whom have editorial responsibility, and get to stick their big fat fingers into your prose and rewrite you or put in new facts or write jokes or stuff that, you know, it's just appalling. None of them are writers. None of them, especially in that Bush White House, were terribly intelligent from what I could see. And then you have to have bureaucratic battles, usually not over all of them, but you have to over a good half of them. And you have to go to the mat sometimes and say, no, we can't have him say this. We can't have. And this is all before the president has even laid eyes on it. The guy who's actually going to deliver the remarks, who is going to be publicly responsible for what he says, hasn't even looked at it. And chances are won't look at it until about an hour before he goes out and does it.
What, if any, was the most, a phrase of yours that Bush uttered, that the first Bush uttered, that made it out into
There weren't.
You didn't come up with "wouldn't be prudent" or anything.
No. He was actually quite funny himself, but he hated giving speeches, and he thought, and this is actually admirable on his part, and it's one of the things I liked about him. He really thought he hated the showbiz aspects of politics. Mm-hmm. He really thought that his job as sort of a blue blood and, you know, a guy from this long line of rich public servants was, you know, to make the government run well. And this politics stuff was showbiz, and it was kind of demeaning, and it was condescending to people. And so the whole idea of him giving a set piece as a speech was just made him uncomfortable. So, which is one of the reasons he hardly ever stuck to the text.
Right.
And he would sort of edit as he went along, and he would sort of say something, and then he'd decide whether he meant it. You know, he'd read the line, like he would say, we had this speech at the Martin Luther King birthplace or something like that, and Coretta Scott King was there, and I had found some story that actually that Bush had said years and years earlier and had used in an article that King had said, and this anecdote. So I put it in the speech, and Bush was up there giving the speech, and he said, Mrs. King, I often think of what Martin said. And no, I really do. I really do often think of this, what Martin said. As though, he said the line, and then he knew, she's not going to believe that. Nobody believes that shit. Right. So then he kind of backtracked and apologized to her, and then he told the story. And, you know, if you're trying to create an effect with your words, forget about it. You ain't going to do it.
Next question.
Okay, so this is kind of changing gears, but we read your review of Barack Obama's books, and in it you kind of talked about how the soul of his writing and personality that was kind of lost between the two books. And I was just curious how that informs your perspective of him and the current elections right now.
Oh. Well, I wrote that piece, you know, before things really got going. I don't think anybody really thought he'd be the nominee, or not very many people.
Wasn't it from the summer? Or was it a
year
ago?
It was the summer before.
Okay, so it was 2007. Yeah, when Hillary Clinton was the presumptive nominee.
Right, right. And there were all these other senators mm-hmm. running, you know, and nobody thought they could get a guy with this little experience.
Right.
I'm really disappointed, to tell you the truth. I don't know if you've read the books, but the first book is the work of an extremely smart and curious and sensitive person who has a great feel for language. And despite all the stuff you hear about how great his speeches are now, if you actually sit down and go through them line by line, it's just an assemblage of cliches. You know, we're going to choose hope over fear. We're going to take the future over the past. Well, that's a bunch of crap. Yeah. And it's not only that, but it's old crap. It's right. stuff that, you know, he could have gotten out of a Jimmy Carter speech in 1976. And
it's odd, too. He doesn't actually have, like, a strong, just rhetorically, a strong reservoir of metaphors or allusions.
No.
I mean, there's no history. There's no literary references. Not even strict biblical references.
Right.
There's kind of a biblical tone, but not...
Yeah, and that's very interesting. And in fact, you kind of see it in a lot of things. From the trivial, for example, he said, they asked him what his favorite movie was, and he said The Godfather. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't choose between part one or two, and part three, everybody knows, is bad. You know, okay, everybody's favorite movie is The Godfather. You know?
Saddam Hussein's favorite movie
reportedly
The Godfather.
That's why they share more than the name, don't they?
Secret Godfather.
But anyway, and then, you know, they asked him his favorite novel the other day, and he said it was Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. Again, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of like something that you get away with by not even having read. I'm not saying that he's lying. It's just that it's just utterly conventional. And then to the big things, like picking his running mate, mm-hmm. who does he get but this political hack, this guy who's been a senator for six terms, is totally embedded in the Washington culture that supposedly he's coming here to change. When he became a politician, he became totally conventional. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, you know, was that an act? I mean, did he write that first book? Is it really as a reflection of him the way it seems to be as you're reading it, or is it just like another guise he's put on as one of a series through his life? And I don't have the answer.
Now, let's, if we can extend this conversation a little bit more, because we talked a bit about this in class. I mean, politically, you are not an Obama fan. I assume that you look upon his agenda and shudder.
To the extent that we know what it is.
Right.
I actually have been, all along, I've been tempted to vote for him. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not sure that I'm not. I don't think I could vote for McCain. But in general, you know, I usually vote for Republicans. That's mm-hmm. true.
Why? What worries you about Obama, and why can't you vote for McCain?
The Obama phenomenon bothers me. Mm-hmm. I hate hero worship. Even though I wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln and mm-hmm. trying to defend what a hero he was, he's been safely dead for 140 years. I look at those Obama rallies, and I see the kind of expectations that he's raising, and I see the look in the eyes of these people, young and old, at the rallies, and I hear them responding to this, what I say is, I think, very shop-worn cliches that he's throwing out. And this isn't a healthy thing in a democracy. I don't like... politics does not have to run on hero worship, and I don't. It scares me a little bit.
So what's the problem with McCain? Has the Weekly Standard has endorsed McCain?
No, yes, no, we don't endorse.
Okay, anybody. You don't endorse anybody. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
I think the big problem with McCain has always been temperament. That And again, this is one nice thing about the campaign is, you know, these guys do end up showing themselves mm-hmm. sooner or later. And you really saw McCain over the last 3 months, you know, jumping around from thing to thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the stock market crashes, so he calls for somebody to resign, mm-hmm. you know, a guy who wasn't really responsible for it. And then he, you know, decides he wants to have Joe Lieberman as his vice president, and he mm-hmm. realizes he can't do it, so he veers in exactly the opposite way. And gets this woman from Alaska. You know, he says he's running on experience, but he chooses somebody who has mm-hmm. no experience and so on. It's just, this is his personality, though. Yeah. This is people who followed him. And Matt Welch, your colleague, mm-hmm. wrote a beautiful book pointing this out chapter mm-hmm. and verse. Yeah. And that bothers me, and I really don't like having a guy like that with his finger on the button, as we used to say.
Yeah, do we still have a nuclear football? Or didn't that get lost at some point in the Clinton years?
Jack Kemp took it.
Okay, another question? Yeah? Chelsea?
On that note, I feel like a lot of, maybe not young generation, because I feel like a lot of kids my age are, I think, are very pro-Obama, but, like, I feel like I'm in the same position that you are for similar reasons. What do you suggest for people that feel like they don't necessarily like either side without the alternative of not voting? What do you suggest?
Yeah, well, I do think that you should probably, I think people should vote, especially if they've taken the time to figure out enough that they don't like either one of these people. I don't know. I mean, what I'll probably do is just leave it blank.
Vote for Pat Buchanan.
And then, or no, I think isn't Bob Barr the one?
Bob Barr is the
great
LP
libertarian
candidate,
standard bearer. But I've also seen him in Washington for years, and he is a lunatic. So. So anyway, I can't really advise you.
And your argument to vote is what?
Because you don't just vote for president, and it does matter who's in the Senate and who's in the House and mm-hmm. who's in your state legislature and that stuff.
Who is your congressman?
My congressman is Frank Wolf.
Okay.
No, actually, they moved it, so now I've got that appalling Jim Moran.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I
lived in Chevy Chase, Maryland for 2 years, and only at the very end did I remember or find out who my congressman was.
That's typical libertarian.
I think so, yeah. Well, I hope that addressed your concern a little bit, Chelsea.
I really don't know, actually. But I do think it's important that you make your case known for the people down ballot, if not at the mm-hmm. top.
What, part of our class talks about interactive media as well as new media and how that's affecting political and cultural discourse. One of the pieces we read was your wonderful piece about Twitter. The new online kind of self-surveillance system that's available. you said it's the worst technology ever. What was the basis of your case? And generally, do you find yourself, as you get older, are you finding more and more distance from media, from new media or new forms of technology, or less?
I thought you were going to say, do you find that you're just getting to be an old man as you get older? Well, yes. Cranky? Yeah, I'm afraid so. Well, I hope it's not just my revulsion at some of this is not just a matter of these kids today. God damn it, get off my lawn, you know. I think that technology very often drives the content of politics. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just change the format in which messages are put forward. And, of course, this is not a new idea. But it actually changes the messages themselves. And I think that to the extent you could have a trace a line over the last, I don't know when it would begin, probably. You could trace a line in the decline of politics.
What do you mean by the decline of politics?
I was going to say political discourse, but that's such a pompous phrase.
Well, we're in a university setting.
The decline of political speech mm-hmm. and the way politicians express themselves and try and persuade the public with the rise of electronic media. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that politics has always been You know, Tippy Canoe and Tyler II is not exactly, you know, a four-point plan.
That's bold, yeah.
And that's an old phrase that means absolutely nothing, right, that apparently was supposed to persuade people in 1840.
And it did, but, right?
Well, he won.
Yeah.
Tippy Canoe won, but then he croaked right
that's
away.
That's right, yeah.
And what I see is the expressions of what the politician wants to say getting shorter and shorter, simpler and simpler, and assuming that the audience is dumber and dumber. I had this...
So you're in the second Barack term, it'll just be ho?
Yeah, well, I think it'll just be pictures. Okay. You know, it will go all the way back to caveman. You know, Twitter will get to be too onerous. It'll just be, all these words in Twitter. I mean, so pretty soon it will just be video and pictures. I had Governor Palin gave this speech to the convention that all of a sudden people were saying was, you know, the most important, the revival of the conservative movement, game changer, you know, the most important speech that a conservative has delivered since, you know, Ronald Reagan's famous speech in 1964. And there is this legendary speech that Reagan gave in support of Barry Goldwater that made Reagan look to everybody like a real substantial figure. So I went back and looked at the speech that Reagan gave in 64. It's a real speech. I mean, this is the work of somebody who is really trying to engage other adults and trying to convince them that certain things are true and certain things are untrue. And then you read Palin's speech, which is a series of one-liners, almost no substance except for, you know, city bad, country good, you know, a wink, stuff like that. And I can't help but believe that technology is the culprit in this.
So if we actually looked at some Marshall McLuhan stuff, the medium is the message and the medium has dumbed things down.
Yeah.
What do you feel that way about, more broadly speaking, cultural discourse? Because one of the arguments certainly at Reason Magazine and that myself and my colleagues have made over the past 10 years or so is that we actually live in a very rich flowering of cultural expression, and that, you know, you can get more good stuff in more different places than ever before, partly because of, you know, some of the same technology probably that is also affecting political discourse in a different direction.
Right. Well, a perfect example is the one I just gave. I was sitting at my desk, and I want to get Reagan's the speech from 64. Yeah, yeah. Bam, I had it. You know, that didn't make Reagan's speech any dumber, the fact that I got it over the internet and so on. But what I do notice is I don't feel a crying need to see a new blog posting from, you know, whatever it is, redstates.com or Andrew Sullivan or whoever. Most of the stuff that you're given access to by this technology that does enrich our lives and stuff is pretty old stuff. You know, I mean, I can go and see every picture in the Louvre sitting in my office. That's terrific, and it's a wonderful use of technology, and I thank God for this wonderful thing that's been invented. On the other hand, the stuff that's the cultural things that have been created since that and that are particularly adapted to the technology are, to me, not enriching, are not elevating, and don't really cultivate the better parts of our humanity.
Another question?
Do you have a personal relationship with Bill Kristol, and if so, what's he like?
I'll tell him you asked that. Yes, well, I've known him... Well, he came to Washington about the time I did, which is 20-some years ago, and I was very friendly with his sister, and I knew his parents before I knew him. And so then in 94, I guess, people have been talking about starting a conservative weekly magazine for a long time, and Bill seemed the logical guy to... get to run it. One of the reasons was, as one of his colleagues said, he had just been instrumental in defeating Mrs. Clinton's big, what they called Hillary Care, which was a huge government program that the Clintons were behind that would have really complicated the healthcare industry, which is already very complicated. And business was dead set against it. Corporate America was dead set against it. And Bill was instrumental as an activist in putting that down. And as a colleague said to me, he said, there isn't a businessman in America that wouldn't write a check for $1 million to Bill Kristol right now. They are so grateful for what he's done. And it, of course, wasn't quite that simple, but Bill is an entrepreneur in that sense. He's sort of an ideological entrepreneur.
You mean to say that he's a merchant of death?
Yeah, well, right. That too.
Yeah, okay.
That
okay.
Too.
Yeah.
So anyway, and so, you know, he was the guy to lead this thing, and then we all sort of signed on. So I, you know, he's one of, he's a very close friend and has been for a long time, and our families are friends. And what's he like? He's the best boss I've ever had. I'll say that. I don't know if that's because I have such a long-standing relationship with him, but he's a wonderful manager of people. The office runs. Everyone has a lot of autonomy, but everything manages to sort of fit together. He trusts all the right people, I think, except for George Bush. And
he's come to see the error of his ways, maybe. Right? How does it work at the Weekly Standard? I mean, there are house editorials, which you do not write, correct?
No.
Yeah.
I've written a couple.
I mean, how tight is the ideological filter kind of turned? Because, I mean, a lot of your I mean, it's like one of the things the students responded to as well is that whatever position you were taking, I mean, it was hard for them to say, okay, you're a conservative or you're a liberal or you're this, because there's, you know, a lot of nuance, a lot of shading in that. But do you feel a need to trim your stated views to fit the larger framework of the Standard?
No. The short answer is no. But there is something else about it. The biggest example would be the war in Iraq and the invasion, which the magazine was advocating as early as 1998
right.
as an editorial stance. Mm-hmm. And we had a cover story, in fact, you know, something remove Saddam or something in 1998. Now, we didn't all sit around a table and decide this. I mean, this is sort of Bill, who is the editor-in-chief, and Fred Barnes, who's the other editor, see things very similarly, and they don't consult me
right.
or anybody else when they're going to do something like that. So if I had really, really disliked the war, I think I could have written something about it. But my attitude towards it was, and this cuts against the Standard's point of view as well as the other, was I think that there are too many, some things are too important to punditize about. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some things that are just too big for us professional BSers to start slinging our opinions around about. And, you know, in 2003, we'd elected this president. He had access, I thought, to information that other people didn't. He said it is absolutely vital that we send troops and get rid of this guy. And, you know, I want the United States to win. I don't want the bad guys to win. And this is why we elect presidents, to make exactly decisions like this.
That's why we elected LBJ, Richard Nixon, all, right?
Well, the point is, it's sort of not, to me, it's just an abuse of, at its heart, doing what I do is kind of frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's one thing to kind of throw around opinions about what the capital gains tax rate should be or what No Child Left Behind is like. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about, you know, the possibility of America killing a lot of people and a lot of Americans mm-hmm. getting killed, I think you ought to shut the hell up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if things go terribly wrong, then as a patriot you have an obligation to speak up. But certainly at that point, you know, I wasn't going to say anything about it.
Let's talk very briefly. We've got a few minutes left about your career, about your kind of professional development. Could you give everybody a quick rundown of, you know, where you came out of and how you ended up where you are?
Well, let's see. I graduated from college in the teeth of a terrible recession in 1978-79, which just lasted and lasted and lasted. So I decided I'd become a rock star because I figured rock music is recession-proof. And, you know, being famous and rich is very recession-proof. And somehow that didn't work out after a year and a half of trying to do that. And so
What was your band's name?
Buddy in the Returnables, named after, you used to be able to buy returnable Budweiser bottles. And so anyway, it's a long story that's not worth it. And then I went to a series of graduate schools, in and out. And
which is rock star for untalented rock star.
Exactly.
I could say that as.
And so I kept remembering this terrible, chilling conversation I had with this woman in the college placement office as I was graduating in 1978. And I took these tests, and they had, you know, people from IBM in and stuff. And the counselor looked at this long questionnaire and the test results, and she said, "You understand, don't you, that you have no marketable skills whatsoever?" And so thinking back on that, I said, "I'll be a writer. I can't be a rock star, I'll be a writer." And so I started trying to write a great American novel and a number of short stories, and papered my wall with rejections from The New Yorker, and then decided that I'd have to get into journalism because it's the only way you could make a living and still have something to do with words. One thing led to another. I was in journalism school in Bloomington, Indiana, and the American Spectator, strangely enough, was located there. And it was a much different magazine in those days. I think it's still a good magazine, but it was much more sort of literarily inclined and more like a New York Review of Books kind of deal. And so it was a great fit for me. And so I went to work for them, then they moved out to Washington, and then one thing led to another.
And you, in Washington, you worked for Washingtonian for a while?
I worked for Scripps Howard Newspapers as a feature writer and editorial writer. And
how did these jobs come your way? I think some of the students would be interested. I mean, was it just that people would get in touch with you after having read your stuff, or were you working to build networks and opportunities?
Yeah, I've always been a terrible network builder. Because I just get nervous when I think I'm about to build a network. You know, it's sort of like holding a fine piece of china, and then your hands start to shake, and I end up destroying my network. I lucked into it. I mean, like this thing with the American Spectator, I was freelancing for a magazine in Southern Indiana, and somebody said, "Why don't you do a profile of this guy who lives in Bloomington, your town there?" R. Emmett Tyrrell, who runs this magazine, and I'd heard of the magazine, so I thought, that's a great idea. It's a freelance assignment. I can make a little money. So I went and I did this profile of him, and we hit it off, and it turned out that they had just hired a new managing editor, which was Malcolm Gladwell, who's now a famous writer with The New Yorker, and I was signed on as the assistant editor. And then Malcolm left, and then I took his place, and it's hard to tell. You know, I blunder into things. I really have not, I've never been good at sort of plotting a career. In fact, I never even thought of this as a career. I was kind of odd when I started to get to know people who do think of journalism in career terms. I was kind of taken aback because I just thought, why aren't we just writing? You know, I didn't know that we were planning a career, but actually, those people who plotted the career have done much better in general.
Okay. That's good to know. Well, I think that wraps it up for today. Thanks again to Andy Ferguson for coming by and talking to us.